Welcome to another week here at the Religious Studies Project. Week 3 of this semester, and
I'm knackered already.
Podcast numbered 71. Although, as we found out today,
it's actually 81.
81, if we count the unnumbered ones. Yeah.
I'm Christopher Carter.
I'm David Robertson, and you're about to hear Pauline Hope Chung on religious authority on the internet.
Indeed, and we're talking to you from Blackfriars Pub on Blackfriars Street in Edinburgh.
Indeed.
With finds of Joker IPA.
Joker IPA quickly becoming a show favourite.
Yeah. This interview was recorded in London at the Digital Media and Sacred Texts Conference that Tim Hutchings organised at the Open University.
And thanks to Tim for facilitating our journey, well, Chris's journey there. But also we've had a lot of support from the OU, so I want to give them a general thanks for the two conferences they've let us go to for nothing. So let's begin.
I am here in London with Professor Pauline Hope Chung of the Hugh Downs School of Human Communication at Arizona State University. So first off, welcome to the Religious Studies Project, Pauline.
Thank you for having me.
Pauline is the she's written dozens of articles in journals such as New Media and Society, the Information Society, Information Communication and Society. So there's a theme coming up there, definitely. And she's been the editor and a co-editor on a number of books, including New Media and Intercultural Communication, and also, perhaps most relevant to what we'll talk about today, Digital Religion, Social Media and Culture, Perspectives, Practices and Futures. So what we're going to be talking about now is the religious authority online, really, and the impact of social media upon that. I've just remembered I haven't put my phone on airplane mode, which I have done now. If you've got a phone nearby...
I've shut it off.
Perfect. Yes. Thank you. You're more prepared than I am. Good. Okay, but before we kick off, if we could just clarify that bit of terminology, religious authority, before we get into that online, what are we meaning by religious authority?
Now, that's a good question. Well, many people have studied the topic of religious authority over the years. Some of them have looked at it from a more sociological angle, in the sense of classifying authority into various types, various forms of legitimation. In my work, given my field of communication studies, I am looking at the communicative constitution of religious authority, how that authority is communicated online and offline, how, because it is communicatively constituted, it is dynamic and it is emergent, and it's also static in the sense of one form of authority. The emphasis is not on the form, the emphasis is on the day-to-day and moment-by-moment constitution, emergent constitution of the authority. And so I look at various online and offline forms as they complement, as they conflict with each other, and looking at text and languaging as part of that religious authority performance.
Mm. So you've started to mention there what you look at, what you do. Perhaps it would be also helpful for our listeners to if you could mention maybe some of the projects that you've been involved in and how you actually research religious authority online, so that they know where you're coming from.
I've been blessed and fortunate to have led several projects in this area, and they're all grant funded on various levels. Most of them are multi-year and multi-method projects. Couple of early ones, for example, dealt with interviewing religious leaders and their perception of the internet. So we've looked at all world religions, Christianity, Buddhism, you know, the Muslim faith, five world religions, and how religious leaders look upon new forms of digital media and how they use that for their own ministry. A more recent project, we've tried to use GIS, geographic information mapping, and how certain online presentations of certain religious communication can be mapped geographically, in different using different sorts of layering technologies that are now used, for example, by many church and as in Christian churches and Buddhist temples, where they actually try to have various multimedia outreaches. So it's not just one, let's say, website. You know, they now have Twitter feeds, Instagram, Facebook, and it's about trying to keep this transmedia authorship online. And so my project looks at this different levels of transmedia authorship. My most recent project, it's a three-year project that's funded by the Social Science and Research Council of Canada. I'm a collaborator on that project, but we have, but I've led research papers on it. We're looking at the one of the largest Chinese Buddhist organizations that has more than 10 million followers, and how they construct religious authority and community using, you know, a whole spectrum of media, from Facebook to satellite television. And so in that, in those more recent papers, we talked about the concept of invocation, how followers would invoke, you know, the leaders' sayings or aphorisms, and how they would repeat and recycle these leaders' sayings online and by, you know, in different forms of Facebook posts, etc., such that authority is not just about presence, but it's also about absence. So in the absence of a religious leader, you know, you can still feel the palpable or the verific forms of authority enforced.
So in what you're saying there, you've alluded to what was going to be my next question, which is when I think about how religious authority is going to be affected by social media, my initial reaction is, oh, well, if you think of a stereotypical parish priest or something, and then suddenly, you know, all their congregation are on Twitter, online, it's going to be a challenge, is my initial thought. It's like, oh, people are going to be coming and saying, oh, I found this online, or this other pastor down the road, he's saying that. But then you've also alluded to how it can actually help construct their authority, in as much as people are retweeting what they're saying, people are quoting them, doing that sort of thing. So
invoking the religious leader in various forms, yes.
Yeah. So in a couple of your articles that I read for this, you talked about those sort of two opposing narratives, and I think you could do it much better than I could.
Well, I think in a lot of popular media, press, and a lot of research, there are words that are thrown out, like social media revolution or Twitter revolution, and those phrases seem to suggest that the use of social media would upset hierarchies, would erode the powers that be, right? And it would, for example, undermine the legitimacy of the local parish priest, as you have said. But a lot of my research suggests that you know, while some of it is happening on a personal and organizational level, because resistance is still expressed, by far and large, we are seeing that followers are taking to social media to support, to exalt, to praise our religious clergy and their interpretations of scripture. So you would see, for example, posts that say, you know, yes, you know, your sermon was great, or, you know, I thought your devotional this week was excellent, etc. And these posts by themselves may seem trivial. Right? So somebody reading it, it's like, oh, it's just a tweet, it's just a post. But if you look at it through on a very large scale, if you scale up, when you think about it holistically or as academics, you think about it theoretically, we are looking at the whole communicative constitution of the authority. So these posts literally would scale up, you know, and it would contribute to the building, the reconstruction of their authority, their legitimacy, their presence, their credibility. And yeah, some leaders are actually loving it rather than resisting it.
Yeah. One thing that comes to mind is my area of research is actually mostly to do with atheists. And my other colleague, David, who's part of the project, he looks a lot at sort of contemporary new religious movements, things like the New Age and things like that. Both of those, you have this model of they're traditionally seen as quite individualistic, and the authority resting with the individual. So it's quite different from there being a sort of clergy figure in that sense. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about what the internet has done to that sense of authority, because actually now you see that atheists, possibly New Agers, I couldn't comment on that, but are forming communities through Twitter and sort of censoring each other through these social media sites in a way that maybe takes authority away from the individual because there's now a community.
Well, your sharing just now just prompted a thought. It said that a lot of people would like to wish authority away, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of these new sort of age groups or new sects of religion, you know, when they're first formed, you know, they want to be this pure utility, you know, free community, commune even, right?
Yeah.
And so there are these, you know, references to how we are, you know, we are leaderless and we are... But research has shown that after a while, after some time, it's the inevitable rise of hierarchy within these communities as well. So you have leaders, whether you call them, you know, they might not be clergy figures, but they are authorities,
yeah,
like webmasters who then serve as gatekeepers of the conversation. They are people who have higher status, whether they are avatars or, you know, forum, you know, people who have executive power within a Wikipedia, for example. So, a wiki, for example. So, there are different roles that indicate power and authority that otherwise might seem, you know, to be counterintuitive to the original intent of these new sects and new communities. So, I don't see that going away, you know. In fact, you know, ironically, you know, some of, you know, these new groups may be more stratified than others.
Right. You've also hinted at there, like, how new, in sort of historical terms, is, like, the phenomena of the internet, in as much as in your articles you mentioned things like the impact of the television or the telephone or the telegraph, the electric bulb,
yes,
and things like that. So when we see the development of the internet in that sort of historical framework, how new is its impact upon religious authority, or has religious authority always been dealing with these sorts of innovations?
Yeah, I mean, the technological developments and forms might change, but I think what is more enduring and perhaps also interesting for us to note, given the very ephemeral nature of social media nowadays, is maybe the larger underlying trend, which is that power tends to consolidate, and that, you know, religious authorities do find creative, innovative, and strategic means to reconstruct, you know, what they've so-called lost, what has been eroded or lost via, you know, digital media development. So I'm seeing it on all levels, you know, whether is it on social media tweets, whether is it, you know, Facebook, you know, or on podcasts or sermons, leaders would cross-reference, you know, their own media products. So a leader, a clergy that is preaching to a congregation might say, well, welcome, you know, congregation X, and for those of you who are listening online, here is, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so this transmedia authorship is a growing phenomenon. I mean, it's a practice that is, I think, growing among a lot of these leaders that I've looked at. I've looked at a lot of larger organizations in some of my studies, but I've also interviewed leaders of smaller churches that are feeling the pressure to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. So I've interviewed leaders that have they've told me that, you know, their congregation members say, why aren't you like leader A in this big church A? You know, why, you know, why don't we have all these facilities, and why isn't your sermon as charismatic as A, right? But these leaders have shared with me that they do feel a bit of the pressure. You know, they want, or they need to be keeping up. So some of these smaller churches, their budgets may be very small, but they're investing in very expensive, you know, LCD screens, and, you know, and of course the downside of it, you know, if you want to think about perhaps the other side of all these development, is that, well, monies that could have gone into supporting orphans and ministries that, you know, are in need in, you know, in developing parts of the world where these monies used to be channeled to, are now channeled to large media departments within the church. So I've interviewed leaders of large organizations that have more than 30 people employed in their so-called media and communications department, which, in, of course, in some time back, you know, 30 people will probably constitute the whole staff of the church, right? But now they constitute just the media department. And in one of my articles, I talked about one of the leaders saying, we can get rid of any other department in church, just not the media department. Which shows you how important the media department is to the clergy, as well as in their minds, how important it is for church growth and community building, etc.
So a concept that comes up quite a lot in your articles is this idea of strategic arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
So that sense of embracing the way things are, but turning it to your advantage in some way. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about what you mean by strategic arbitration.
Yes, that concept was inspired by legal language, actually. So when a lawyer deals with clients, he arbitrates between various texts and discourse with his clients, right? So if they have a dispute, he needs to be the one arbitrating, that interaction. But in the midst of the dispute, the lawyer deals with different texts in front of him, as well as the verbal testimony of his clients. Well, you could argue that a clergy plays the same role nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
There are many competing texts online, so the clergy has to deal with all these competing texts online. His or her followers might present the clergy with competing texts. So they will say, Pastor A, I found this other interpretation of this verse online, and you said this on during Sunday sermon. What can you explain that conflict? Right, so there are there might be possibly various competing, conflicting texts, and so the clergy is now faced with the responsibility as well as added pressure. One might add, and I would argue actually a lot of labor, emotional and physical and intellectual labor, to strategically arbitrate, to strategically work among these competing texts, and to do that in such a way that he or she maintains his or her credibility and legitimacy within the congregation. And so my research has shown various ways in which how this strategic arbitration might take place. One way is to, of course, construct new norms. So the norm might be to, in some churches, stress physical presence within the church.
Yeah.
So, you would say that, the church might say things like, we value social media, but you still have to come to church to do X, Y, and Z, whether is it Holy Communion, whether in the Buddhist sense, is it meditation where you feel the energy between the followers. And their argument is you cannot replicate these energy points online. So that's one way of building up these new norms. Another way is multimedia or transmedia authorship, right? So the leader tries to address his followers in every platform available. So now, with Instagram, you have leaders taking pictures with celebrities. Here am I, I'm looking good today. I'm looking tired I'm looking very tired because, I've just spent the whole of the weekend preaching to 5,000 people, So poor me, but, it's all captured, Instagram where a picture supposedly says 1,000 words, right? So, so multimedia authorship is another avenue. In today's presentation, which I've just given in the conference on digital media and sacred texts, leaders influence how they would author the text makes a difference too. So even in writing tweets, right, they would capitalize certain parts of scripture that they want to emphasize. Right? So a Bible verse may say blah, 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 but a leader might capitalize strategic words that he or she wants to stress so that it becomes a lesson for the follower.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might recombine verses, or they might put verses with images and other things. And tweets then, short as they might be, they might then serve as micro sacred texts for the followers.
Something that... there's two things I really want to ask right now, but we'll go with the first one, which will obviously be the first one, because it'll be the first that I'll say. This idea of sort of constructing tradition seems to come up a lot, in as much as you say they maybe emphasize the necessity of being in a particular physical location. Is there a sense that that might not have always been such an emphasis, but this is sort of a constructed tradition to cope with the current situation, whereas maybe 20 years ago those sorts of messages wouldn't have been emphasized.
Mm-hmm. I think it also depends, of course, which religious tradition
Definitely.
We're talking about. Just to provide an illustration to what you just said, I, for example, interviewed a Buddhist nun that said that they used to put PowerPoints of their teachings online, and then they discovered their attendance dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a U-turn policy in their temple, and they decided to not put PowerPoint, you know, slide their meditation notes online. So in that case, it suggests or links back to what you've just said, right?
Mm-hmm.
That leaders themselves are thinking through these strategies of
mm-hmm.
how best and when and how to represent themselves as well as represent their teachings on various platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And decisions are made, you know, by, of course, on different points in the journey.
And the social media, in a sense, then becomes a performance of authority.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that comes to mind is that in the past, you know, that the, I'll keep using the traditional parish priest or whatever, would have been seen as a sort of distant figure who came with all this learning, presented a sermon, and was quite sort of untouchable, maybe, in a sense. Whereas now, you have people saying, oh, I'm just brushing my teeth. But is there a sense that even these banal tweets are part of performance? It's all calculated in a way. Can you...
Mm-hmm. In one of my forthcoming articles, I talked about the religious celebrification
mm-hmm.
of top Twittering clergy, right? And one of the interesting findings that I found, and I looked at, you know, it was a large data set of top US Twittering clergy. And one of the common strands that was found between and among these this of so-called elite religious elites is they will tend to insert intimate details of their family life
mm-hmm.
within these tweets. So you know a lot of them are male, given you know with their profile number of followers. So the top Twittering clergy, a lot of them are male. They're also female ones, but you know they will say things like, "I know attended a football game with my son or daughter, or had a hot date with my wife." You know, and it'll be part of them performing their role as a dutiful husband
mm-hmm.
or as a responsible family man, right? And recently I was talking to the president of a seminary, and he said that something that, you know, really resounded with my findings. He said that a lot of pastors will not share things online that are not culturally acceptable.
Right.
So, for example, in the US context, it's fine for a pastor to share that he's battling with alcoholism, but it's less culturally acceptable for a pastor to share a tweet or Facebook that I'm battling with I'm a pedophile or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
because that's just, that will be, you know, not culturally acceptable. So this brings us back to the point of how performances are actually culturally shaped or
mm-hmm.
they're cultured. Because in different societies, certain things would be more, you know, seem to be more credible, right? So if a US pastor tweets about his struggle with alcoholism, it seemed to be identifying the common man. It's like, that is the, you know, I am building this intimate relationship with my followers because I trust them enough to share these details with them. But if he shares that he's battling with pornography, then it's like, oh,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm no longer a credible, you know, a pastor. And so, ironically, on one hand, some pastors would say that, you know, their tweets are meant to be, you know, snippets of everyday life.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, another way of looking at it is these tweets are actually not private sharings, but public-private sharings
mm-hmm.
that are shared on the belief that they will be culturally sort of validated and accepted. So there's this paradox, right? So you want
mm-hmm.
to derive intimacy with your pastor on these tweets, but at the same time, you might be building more barriers because a lot of this information is just not so-called authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to have time for one more question because we've got to get down for Heidi Campbell's keynote lecture, and I don't think she would appreciate us coming in late. And we've covered a lot of ground there and given a really good introduction, and I'll make sure that I link to as many of your papers as I can when we put the podcast out. But I'm just wondering, this is obviously a very new and constantly evolving research field. What are the new directions that you see being explored in the coming years, or what would you like to see more research done on?
Well, I mean, there is just social media is exploding in a sense, you know, with in terms of outreach in terms of different screens and platforms that are out. So, you know, what are the different affordances of these new screens and platforms that are that might be facilitating changes in the ways that leaders and followers interact? Right, so that might be, that's a very big question, but you can apply that big question to, you know, whatever new technology comes up, be it an app. So very little research done on religious apps that are theoretically framed and they are understood in a more detailed sense, but we could look at it, you know, in that sense. Are leaders using apps to interact with their followers? Mm-hmm. How are they using them? You know, and is their authority, how is their authority communicated via apps? Right. Of course, for me, I would also like to see research is done in other parts of the world besides, of course, North America, where a lot of this research emanates. But so in my small effort, I've tried to look at organizations in Asia as well as North America. But, you know, I've tried to at least broaden the range a bit. But yeah, definitely more research done in other parts of the world, in other languages, in other cultures, so that we'll be able to do some cross-comparative work to see how that authority is communicated via, you know, these different communicative platforms.
Wonderful. We'll have to leave it there. So, Pauline Chong, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So, David, you've just been listening to the interview there with me and Pauline Chong. You had a bit of news, I guess, to pass on about religious authority on the internet?
Well, yes. Let me get there by a rather roundabout route.
Okay.
The first thing to say is that on Wednesday, the response to this interview will be, well, has been, written by our very own Louise Connolly, who we don't hear enough of.
But we're going to hear on Thursday, I think.
Yeah, well, I saw her online yesterday, but yeah. We are going to see her next week, so maybe we can try and record an intro next week. That'd be nice. It'd be nice to hear her. However, Louise Connolly has also recently published
a few things.
She's published a few things recently, one of which was an article that she co-wrote with Heidi Campbell. Heidi Campbell, we've had an interview with her on the show, in fact, by Louise, is regarded as one of the authorities on religion online and online religion. Both of those. See our earlier interview for clarification on that one. But she's currently working on a new project, interestingly, on the subject of religious authority on the internet, particularly looking at social media and stuff.
Yeah, and well, it's quite funny because we have quite a large presence on the internet and on social media, and we talk about religion.
This is absolutely true. And this is what Heidi Campbell thought, and that's why she interviewed me for a chapter in the forthcoming book in her project on religious authority on the internet.
Yeah.
So how's that for an interlocking mesh of references?
And as I mentioned in the interview, the interview's a bit shorter than some of our interviews because we had to get back downstairs for Heidi Campbell's keynote lecture at the conference.
So that is as close to a punchline as you're going to get.
Oh,
I mean, that's
secret,
it's a web of a network.
It is.
Wow.
Oh, surfing USA. What was that? So, next week, we have the pleasure of bringing an interview with François Gautier on religion, neoliberalism, and consumer culture. But
I think that's easy for you to say.
It was really, really easy for me to say. Not only do we have pleasure bringing you that interview, because it should be a fantastic interview, but we're introducing a new member of the RSPT.
Interviewess.
Hmm. Hannah Lettinen, she has written three pieces for the website, actually, so you can troll through that now and, you know, work out what your opinion of Hannah is before you hear her. Love her, hate her, who knows?
I'll not hear it, Chris. I don't think anybody could hate Hannah.
Exactly. So we're delighted to welcome her next week with that interview.
Yeah, this last 6 months, a lot of what Chris and I have been focusing on behind the scenes is building up this international team of interviewers, and Hannah is one of several new additions, but We're very pleased with the way that the team is going and the work they're producing.
Yeah.
Hannah's got a couple of interviews coming up for us starting next week, and we'll hopefully record an introduction with her before her next one in a few weeks.
We're always, when we're talking about things that we're delighted about, we're delighted to be associated with the British Association for the Study of Religion.
Yes, we absolutely are.
And thanks to them, as always, check out their website, basra.ac.uk, as they tend to say in the industry. And keep looking on our Amazon pages, buying things, and social medias, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes.
Do use the Amazon links. That's a fantastic thing. It costs you nothing, but it supports our work.
It's a nice way it comes.
And the community in general.
It does. Well, I think we've exhausted everything we've got to say this week. So from Blackfriars,
thanks for listening.